And I know that only God could change me sufficiently to live in a relationship like other normal human beings do. All of a sudden, I was no longer jealous. I don't know what happened. I was insanely jealous. I used to question my wife about her relationships before she ever knew me. Insane. Somehow like that reflected on me. I accused her of having our children by somebody else. Insane. Insane. And somehow I think that because I make up my mind or I'm not drinking anymore, that I can change that sort of insane behavior. Of course I can't. Only God can change me. Only God can. He uses you, but only God can change me. Only God can change those things in my life that are warped and perverted, that those kinds of behaviors that determine I must do it again. I must do it again. Scripture talks about the dog who returns to his vomit. And that described the way I live my life in all areas of my life. And I came to realize that only God could change that. I couldn't change it because it made sense to change it. I couldn't change it because of what Freud or Jung or Adler or anybody else said. I couldn't change it because I read Aquinas and Augustine. I couldn't change it because I read great philosophers. I could only change it with the power of God. It was a deal having to do with me and God. And of course, I don't trust just me and God without another person involved. So in the situation with my relationship, I went to my sponsor. Tom I is married the way I wanted to be married, to the same woman. He's dedicated to that woman. But they have a lot of fun together, too. They kid each other and they joke around a lot. Her name's Fern, and she's from Canada. So when he brought her to North Carolina, he renamed her Magnolia. And I watched them. I didn't just watch how they lived together when things were going well. I watched how they were in crisis. I watched how they were when Tom was in trouble in his job because of political things. And I watched how he dealt with it, and I watched how they dealt with one another. And I saw a man who was worried and angry and upset and everything else. And the minute he was in the presence of his wife, he treated her like she didn't have anything to do with what was wrong in his life. I mean, that's not wise, what wives are for. Wives and husbands are there to be blamed for what's wrong in our lives. And he didn't even blame her for what the state of North Carolina had done to him. And God knows she was responsible. She was from Canada. I watched him immediately shift gears and treat her with the kindness and gentleness and love that he felt for her. And he didn't have to let all this stuff come out sideways into their relationship. And I watched that. And I went to him and I said, "Would you teach me how to be in relationship?" And he said, "I'd be glad to." I said, I'm a late starter. I'm into my 40s, but I don't know anything about living life with another human being." He said, "I'll tell you what I know." He said, "But you can't do anything until, you got to promise not to do anything until you talk to me about it." I said, "I will." And I told him where I was. And you know, the same thing that would have happened before happened. 3 weeks after I'm dating this woman, I go to Tom and say, "Well, this is it. I think it's time for a exclusive relationship." So I think it's kind of early. I said, "No, I think it's just about right." And he said, "What makes you think it's time for an exclusive relationship?" I said, "Well, I didn't just feel it." He said, "Well, I want you to figure out what those feelings are and talk to me about them." It didn't take long. I mean, you're sober 13, 14 years. You've got to start catching on eventually. And I knew what the feelings were. The feelings were, if she had to choose between me and anybody else, she would certainly choose anybody else. So what I had to do was capture her. I had to take her prisoner right away. Because if anybody else had a shot at her, I'd lose. And then I knew what the result would be. Because I had done something I was forced to do, because I was fear-driven, because it wasn't a choice that I wanted, I would then begin to blame her for why what happened happened. And then the relationship would start on the same destructive mode that every other relationship I'd ever had with a woman started on. So he said to me, "I don't think you're ready." I said, "Okay." He said, "You let me know when I'm ready." He said, "I will. We'll keep talking about it." And even Julia came to me and said, "Well, I'm ready for an exclusive relationship." I said, "Well, are you willing to have one if I don't? Because my sponsor says I'm not ready for an exclusive relationship yet." And she said, "No." She said, "You know, I like what's happened to your life since as you're a sober person." She never knew me drunk. And so one day I just knew it was kind of right. And I went to Tom, I said, I think I'm ready. He said, I think you are too. He said, how is it when you date other women? I said, dull. I said, they're nice people, but I don't even want to chase them. He said, you might be ready. And so we started an explicit relationship. And then I said to him one day, I said, Julie and I are going to get married. And he said, well, that's nice. He said, but aren't you going to become engaged first? I said, nah, it's an old-fashioned idea. He said, well, Keith, it got to be that way for a reason. And I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, I want you to become engaged. And I want you to be engaged for a period of time. He said, not like a week. No, it used to be, in the old days, engagement lasted until the pregnancy test came back. He said, I want you to do it differently. So I bought her a ring, and I gave it to her Christmas Eve. We were getting ready to go to midnight mass, and I had a little house by this time over on the golf course on the 10th green for you aficionados. It was about a 380-yard par 4. And we'll get back to the story. Don't know the slope rating. I had this thing all planned, and I had a little fire in the fireplace and everything, and I was dressed for church, and she was too, and we're sitting in front of the fire, and I had this ring in my pocket, and I had practiced this. I mean, I knew exactly what I was going to do, and it was going to be magnificent. And just as I was to start into my act, she said, excuse me, and she went into the powder room to check her makeup before she went to church, and I was out of control by this time, so I just ran in the bathroom behind her, and I grabbed her, and I put the ring on the wrong finger with the wrong hand and asked her if she would consider marrying me. And she just fell into my arms. And she said, there's nothing I would rather do. It was amazing to me. And we went to Mass that night. Neither of us could keep from crying. And I understood why being engaged was different than being in an exclusive relationship. And we were engaged for about a year and a half. And I said to Tom, I said, well, I think we're about ready for marriage. He said, I think you are too. And I said, Julia has an opportunity to transfer her job. She works for the state. She can transfer it. I said, she has an opportunity to transfer her job. So I thought until we got married, she'd just move in with me and we'd live together. Tom said, no. He said, you come so far. Why would you ruin it now? I said, what do you mean? He said, Keith, you're not cut from that cloth. He said, you're a member of society. He said, you're a long-term member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, the way you live your life matters. People watch how you live your life. He said, why would you want to jeopardize your life in that relationship by living together before you're married? He said, don't you think God can find Julie a job when it's time? And I said, of course he can. So I took that advice. It was some of the best advice I ever took. And then one day we were married. And as long as I live, I look at those wedding pictures to this day. I can't believe it. Her mom and dad were still alive, and they were there, and my mom and dad were alive, and they were there, and her sister and things. And I see this beautiful woman standing next to this old fat guy. And I thought, I never believed something like this could happen. And it did. And it didn't happen because I made it happen, and it didn't happen because I planned it. It happened because I was willing to follow a simple direction and to live my life based upon spiritual principles. And that's the sixth and seventh step of Alcoholics Anonymous. Knowing what's wrong will never change me. The only thing that will change me is the power and the grace of God. Because I desperately want to do it. I need him in my life. And I'm willing to follow the directions of someone I want to be just like when I grow up. And that to me is the finest description of working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous I'd come up with. One day I want to be like Tom. I want to live my life the way he lives his life. I want to reflect in my life the values that he reflects in his life. Humbly ask God to remove these defects of character. I like to say humbly on my knees, ask God to remove these defects of character, holding back nothing. There are so many areas of our lives where we can talk about these principles. I'm sponsoring a guy who has a gambling problem. And a lot of guys I know have a gambling problem. And the gambling problem is dealt with the same way as all the other problems. Now, if he's truly compulsive gambler, then I'm going to send him to someone who can help him with his compulsive gambling. I think he's a guy who doesn't want to make a budget, and he's involved in magical thinking, and one day he's really going to hit it big and he'll never have to worry again. I always tell him he reminds me of my friend who quit his job to concentrate full time on winning the clearinghouse sweepstakes. It's a series of, it's a form of magical thinking that makes things come about without any change on my part. And of course, that doesn't work. It doesn't work. So he's not gambling one day at a time. He's not picking out numbers. He's not doing the kinds of things that he used to do, which he knew was God's will for him. We can go into every area of our lives. I won't do that because we're about out of time. But the principles I'm trying to, I think that are elucidated in the sixth and seventh step is that basically this. I can't change because I want to. I can't change because I think it's a good idea. I can't even change because I have to. I can only change because I ask God to supply the power to me to cause that change to come about. I'm a guy with a lot of willpower. And you know the old joke about willpower lasting, with diarrhea. The same thing is true with willpower about any of my character defects. I can actually force myself to change my behavior for a period of time, almost long enough to convince myself it's not a problem anymore. Then I can go back and do it again. The seventh step is different than that. The seventh step is allowing God to work in our lives. And it says, he doesn't render us as pure as snow. A lot of times humility comes because I fail time and time and time and time again. Even with God's cooperation or trying to cooperate with God's plan and with the help of other people, there are still areas in my life in which I continue to fail. That doesn't make me a loser or a bad guy. It makes me a guy more in need of the mercy of God and more in need of close contact with members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Paul talks about it beautifully in Scripture. Paul says, I always do what I don't want to do and I never do what I want to do. And that describes perfectly to me the dilemma of the sixth and seventh step. I'm really impressed with those of you who are sitting in here on a fine afternoon like this with the sun shining and the water right out there and the golf course not too far away. I think it speaks volumes about what your motives are. A lot of you could be out seeking balance at a time like this. And you're here seeing the spiritual growth and things like that, and I congratulate you. I've really been enjoying myself thus far. I look forward to the speaker tonight and everything, but I haven't particularly enjoyed standing up here chirping away for 4 or 5 hours, whatever it is now, but I certainly have enjoyed meeting many of you and having an opportunity to talk to you. What's interesting about that to me is that prior to Alcoholics Anonymous, you provided nothing but opportunities for fear in my life. I would immediately judge you, probably at about 150 yards, and then I would have to figure out how I had to deal with you, and then I would have to figure out how I'd have to get rid of you. I was truly a stranger in the world. And the eighth and ninth step were designed to take care of people like me who felt as though they were strangers in the world. I was one of those kids who, I've heard people say they felt like they were adopted. I go further, I felt as though I'd been put on the wrong planet. I just had no sense of self and no sense of belonging anywhere. And I had so misjudged and misconstrued things in my life that I had arranged an environment in which I could never find any sort of comfort. And the fourth and the fifth step began to show me in a general way what I had done to destroy the environment in which I lived, what I had done to cause mistrust and to never be able to generate or develop any kind of trust. I found that the fourth and fifth step presented to me in a very realistic picture what the problems were. The sixth and seventh step convinced me beyond a shadow of a doubt that left to my own devices I could never change. I would have to remain the same. Steps eight and nine sort of brought all of that together and gave me practical things to do. The same gentleman, Father Bob H., who talks about the man pushing the wheelbarrow across the tightrope, also used to say something about the second step. He used to say, faith is in your feet. People used to say, I need more faith. And he'd say, if you need more faith, you need to do more with your feet. Faith is in your feet. Your feet need to be taking you to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Your feet need to be taking you to talk to your sponsor. Your feet need to be taking you to where the newcomers are, because your faith is in your feet. And I think that's true. There's little or nothing that's theoretical about the recovery process in Alcoholics Anonymous. Sobriety really is a program of action. And once we get past those first two steps where we do a lot of thinking and a lot of considering and that sort of thing, then we get into the heart of the matter, which is the 12 steps, and mainly steps 3 through 12. If I thought, I hear a lot about people talking about being at peace with themselves. And I sponsored a fellow one time in another part of the country that really was a man who completely lacked peace. I mean, he was an interesting guy. He was a very self-absorbed individual, and a lot of us are when we first come in. But he was uniquely self-absorbed. I remember he used to tell me, he'd say, you know, I see stars. When I close my eyes, I see stars. And I'm thinking, well, this guy's really filled with anxiety, and, you know, when you're anxious and you close your eyes, you know, you see things and everything. So, and he'd talk about it and talk about it. And I begin, like I usually do, I usually make light of people's problems, because if they can laugh at them, they're usually not quite as serious as they were. And he said, when you close your eyes, you ever see stars? I said, well, I see Raquel Welch. And then I ran through a few other names, and he said, this is serious, this is serious. And I said, okay. He said, I think I'm losing my mind. Whenever I close my eyes, I see stars. So I, you know, thinking about it, and somewhere along the line, I bumped into a guy who just happened to mention that when he closed his eyes, he saw stars. And he said, I was very anxious and things. I said, great. I said, you're just the guy I've been looking for. So come with me. So I took him over and introduced him to this guy. And I said, tell him what you told me. And the guy said, well, he said, when I close my eyes, I see stars. And this guy said, really? He said, yeah. He said, what color? He said, well, I guess silver. He said, and mine are red and blue and green, things like that. So he walked away. So here's a man who had decided he was going to bask in his uniqueness. Now, he went on and got over the star bit, but the point is that he had created an environment which made it almost impossible for anyone to help him, anyone to even get near him, because he was that unique. And one of the great things about step meetings over the years, my home group is the Midtown group in Wilmington, North Carolina, and we meet at 7 o'clock on Mondays and Thursdays. If you're ever in town, please come. It's a wonderful group. On Mondays, we have a person who shares in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what they're like now for 20 minutes or 25 minutes. And then from their short story, they take out a topic, and then they lead the second half of the meeting on a discussion on that topic. And then on Thursdays, we have a step study, and we study directly out of the 12 and 12. We have somebody read it while we sit and listen. There's something very, very beneficial about hearing someone read that while I'm listening to them and reading along with them. And then we discuss that particular step. And I've always had my home group be a step study group or a big book study group, because I never want to get too far away from the practice of these principles and too much into theory. I tend to theorize too much anyway. But the eighth and ninth step are the steps that take all of this out of the theoretical and they put it into practical application. The eighth and ninth step have taken a guy who was felt as though he was a complete misfit, pointed out the character defects, got me in a position to beg God to change me, and then gave me the opportunity to become a full-fledged member of society, to truly live in the place that I was planted, and to bloom as best I could where I was planted. And the eighth step is a very, very simple one. I mean, people make so much out of it, but it's very simple. Sandy said to me, I want you to make a list of persons you had harmed. I said, okay. I said, I'll do that as soon as I become willing to make amends to them all. He said, no. I said, that's not what it says. It says, make a list of persons we had harmed. I said, well, I'm going to do that as soon as I become willing. He said, no. He said, it's got nothing to do with willingness. So he took my yellow pad and my number two pencil, and he wrote list. He said, now start listing people that you've harmed. Well, it's harm's a relative term. He said, all right, start with your relatives and then go to all the other people that you've harmed. Had a hard time. You could never get around Sandy. And of course, he pointed out that I already had a list of people, and they were the list that I began with in my fourth step. There were a lot of names that were generated as a result of that list. I've always been a little concerned about those people who, I know it's very dramatic, and I'm sure that some psychologist somewhere would be really pleased, but I'm always concerned when people hear someone's fifth step and then they say, let's go, we'll go out together and we'll burn it in the fireplace or someplace, I don't know, you know. And you always wonder, what the hell are they doing with those names that are on that list? I mean, that's the basis of the eighth step. What are they doing with those names? But different strokes for different folks, I suppose. But I certainly had generated an awful lot of names, and they went on that eight-step list, and it was very important for me, like in the fourth step, not to think about the fifth step as best I could. I discovered in the eighth step it was very important to focus on the eighth step, to focus on the harms that I had done people, and not to think about what it's going to be like when I go to this schmuck and admit it. And so I had to keep the ninth step as separate from the eighth step as I possibly could. And the way I did that was with the help of my sponsor. He told me, he said, your only job is to put down the names. He said, at the last minute, I may determine you shouldn't go to them, that you don't owe them an amends at all. That at the last minute, I may say, wait a minute, don't go make an amends to them. They owe you an amends. I thought, well, I can put those names down if that's the case, because, you know, hope springs eternal. And I, on some level, really did believe that there were a lot of people who owed me an awful lot. And I've heard people jokingly say, if you don't know how to make an amends list, make a list of people you think ought to make amends to you. I was sponsoring a guy one time, and his slightly pre-Al-Anon wife called me up and said, it was about midnight, and she said, when's he going to get, I've been reading these steps, when's he going to get to this ninth step? I said, why? He said, he owes me a lot of amends. I have a list of things here that he, you know, it's really funny. You know, the other cautionary aspect, and when you talk to people, they'll always say, you know, the eighth step comes eighth. And I forgot that or didn't know that or never heard it. And I was sober about 5 weeks. And I went out of this treatment center and I'm back in my little apartment. And I called my estranged wife and asked her to come over. And I explained to her all about the 12 steps, all about them, and I explained to her about the 8th step, and I said, I haven't made a list yet, but you're going to be the first on the list. And of course, what I was doing was manipulating her to get back into the big bed. And she said to me, she listened for a little while, and she said, well, that's really fine. She said, I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad that you finally realized how wrong you are. And that she said, I'll have your lawyer call my lawyer. I have some concrete ideas about what you can do to make amends. And of course, I lost it, and I came apart like a cheap suit and called her all the names I called her drinking. And she smiled, and that smile that she had, which says I won, and said to me, you haven't changed a bit. And now the worst thing you could say to me was, I haven't changed a bit. And we were talking at lunchtime about those kinds of relationships, and I think it's probably worth mentioning when we talk about the eighth step. There were certain people in my life that I kept going back to sober, trying to get them to tell me I was somebody. And my ex-wife was one of them. And And it would go something like this. I'd get lonely or something, and I'd call her up, and I'd say, why don't you come on over, and we'll talk things over. Maybe we can work out our problems. And I had less trouble with impotence with her than anybody else, so she was very important to me. And it was always the same routine. She'd get somebody to watch the kids, and then she'd come over to my house, and then we'd begin talking, and then we'd end up in bed together, and then when that was over, we'd end up questioning each other about who we'd seen and what we were doing and on and on, and then we'd begin accusing, and then we'd begin, and we'd end up in the same fight we'd always ended up in, and then she would end up telling me, you haven't changed a bit, and then I'd feel like a loser. And so finally, one day I called her and said, well, why don't you come over? And she said, well, I can't, I have a date tonight. I said, well, why don't you come over after the date? She said, well, I may not leave his place till tomorrow. I said, well, why don't you come over then? And like a light came on. And I said, that's really sick. I mean, just like, what a revelation. And she said, that's right, you're really sick. And I said to her, I said, you know, I don't think I'm going to need you to come over anymore. She said, yes, you will. I said, no, I think I can stay away from you the same way I do a drink, one day at a time. And I called my sponsor, and I told him what had been going on, and he kind of suspected, you know. And he said, well, I'm glad you've arrived at this decision. He said, you know, so I'd like to make a suggestion. And I said, what's that, Dan? I said, I'll do anything. He said, well, he said, if you ever want to know how you're doing, why don't you ask me? I'm your sponsor. He said, it's not a good idea to ask your ex-wife or her lawyer. He said, they're really not in the business of making you feel good about yourself. I thought, well, that makes sense. That really makes sense. But it was something about my life, about the needs I had to go back to certain people and to try to make them tell me things that I thought I needed to hear. And she was one of them. My parents were another. I'm sober, and I'm sober for, you know, a short period of time. And I was granted a scholarship, and so I'm back in school and working and going to meetings. And I found myself, I was 30 years old, and I was calling my parents to tell them what my grades were. And I remember one semester I carried 12 hours, and I had 3 A's and a B. And I said, oh, I have 3 A's and a B. That's a 3.75. And my mother said, well, that's nice, son. What'd you get the B in? And it suddenly occurred to me that I was trying to manipulate this woman into telling me that I was okay. Now, I was dealing with two people who loved me very, very much, but they had different ideas. Their ideas were, if we tell you you're doing well, you'll stop. You'll let that up. So we were working at cross purposes. And instead of continuing to be angry and disappointed and making these demands on them, I realized in the eighth step that my job wasn't to make demands on them. My job was to stop making demands on them. That if I continued to make demands on them, I'd probably get the same answer I'd always gotten. It didn't mean they didn't love me. It simply meant that they didn't understand what it was I was asking them for. And so I began to change the questions. And one of the ways I changed the questions was I stopped going to people for things that they weren't capable of giving me. It didn't make them bad. It just made them incapable of giving me those things. You know, my parents weren't capable of telling me I had done very, very well until it didn't matter anymore. And once it didn't matter anymore, they fell all over themselves telling me how well I was doing. And I don't know how that works or why it works. It's just the way that it does work. I know that. So certainly I had my parents very high on the list. I had my ex-wife high on the list. And I'll sort of get 8 and 9 a little confused in the telling because that just happens that way. But my ex-wife was one of those people that I could not make direct amends to. I mean, I'd try to, and she was on my list, and I'd pray for the ability to forgive her. And then I'd go to see her. And we wouldn't talk for 5 minutes until we were in a knockdown, drag-out battle. It was just amazing. It was like putting two mad dogs together in the same yard. It was unavoidable. So I kept saying to Sandy, it'll never work. I can't make amends to that woman. It'll never work. And he kept saying, well, you probably haven't prayed quite enough. He said, if you pray a little bit more, it'll probably work. And then finally, he said to me, he said, if you can't make direct amends to her, he said, why don't you try to find a way to make amends in an another way. And so I thought about it, and I prayed about it, and I got a letter from the Internal Revenue Service. And the letter stated that they wanted me to call them. There was some question about our income tax returns. And so I called the lady, and she said, I've noticed for the last couple of years that you have deducted Kelly, and your ex-wife has deducted Kimberly. Well, this year, she deducted both of them, and she hadn't said anything to me about it. And she said, if you'll send me a copy of your divorce agreement, I will bill your wife for the taxes. And I said, no, I don't want you to do that. I said, I want you to bill me. And she said, well, you made a little more money than her, so she'll be paying less taxes. I said, well, I appreciate that, but I really want you to bill me. And I said, I want you to know how grateful I am for this opportunity. And a woman said, Mr. Lewis, this is the strangest phone call I've ever had. And and I went on to explain to her about making amends and the necessity of making amends. And I'm going on and on about this. I was so excited that God had found a way for me to make amends. When it was all finished, the lady said, well, she said, I'm glad I wasn't married to you, but I sure as hell wish I had divorced you. And and you know, a funny thing happened when I talked to my ex-wife the next time on the telephone. We didn't argue. It was the strangest thing. And even more strange, I didn't have to point out to her that I knew what she had done and that it had caused me trouble and on and on. I didn't have to say any of those things. All I had to do was write a stupid check and make sure every year from then on I never deducted Kelly again. It was so simple to make direct amends to this woman in an indirect way. And the simple part was not having to remind her of what she had done to me. So I stopped being a victim, and it allowed me to stop victimizing. I was able to do the things that I'd always wanted to do. When she became engaged, I was truly pleased for her. And then I asked if I could meet her fiancé. And we talked, a real nice man. And he was concerned how the kids might react to them getting married. And I said, what can we do? And he said, I don't know, what do you suggest? I said, why don't we take the girls to dinner? And let's explain to them that it's okay that they like both of us. And he said, would you do that? I said, I'd love to do that. So Jeff and I took Kelly and Kimberly to dinner, and we talked over about marriage and about divorce and about how unfortunate it is, but you get other chances and more than one person can love you and everything. And they were just little kids, and they were greatly relieved that they didn't have to choose between me and the man that their mother was marrying. And you know, we've remained reasonably close ever since. I mean, he's my husband-in-law. You know, you ought to stay in touch. And you know, some interesting things has happened as a result of that. I don't often talk about these things because in a way that they aren't resolved yet. But Jeff suggested to my ex-wife that she really might want to get off my case, that a lot of their happiness hinged on how they got along with the kids, and a lot of that was determined by me. And he suggested to her, why don't you let him be the best kind of father he can be and stop instructing him on how to do that. And she did. And then he told me that you're always welcome in this house. And from time to time I would be in that house. And then I moved to North Carolina, and he pointed out to me that that anytime I wanted the kids to please feel free to give them a call, and he would do whatever he could to make sure that we spent time together or got together. He just couldn't have been a nicer man. And he called me up one day, and he told me he had a problem and asked me if I'd be willing to help him. And I said, what's the problem? And he said, well, it's child support. And he said, he said, if your check comes a day early, my wife's happy. And if it comes a day late, she's angry. And he said, he's a surgeon. You know, so he said, I make more money before breakfast than you send. I said, I know. And he said, is there any way I can talk you into not sending that money? And I said, well, I couldn't do that. I said, I have a moral obligation. It's the first thing on the list. Send child support. And he said, I was afraid you'd take that position. He said, look, think about this. This is a real problem. He said, I'm tired of you living in my house. And I said, you told me I was welcome there any time. He said, not the first of every month. And so I thought about it, and I talked to my sponsor about it, and it was easily resolved. I called him up, and I said, you know, if I pay child support between now and such a time, and I figured out what it would be and everything else. I said, you know, you would invest wisely. How would it be if I send you a lump sum of money and you invest it for the children? And he said, would you do that? I said, I'd be glad to. And that's what we were able to do. That's what we were able to resolve. And so there are a million ways that miracles happen as a result of the eighth step, the willingness to forgive in the eighth step. The second chapter of that story is, it turned out there was a reason I really liked this guy. And it seems that he might be one of us. And when it came time for the weddings, both of my daughters are married, when it came time for the weddings, he had caused a little bit of dissension and consternation around the house, and did a lot of the things I had done. And both of my daughters were extremely angry with him. And they said that they weren't going to, he wasn't going to walk them up the aisle, and they're going through all this business. And I was able to take his side of the argument. I said, you know, there's no difference between him and me. I said, we got the same thing. And my daughter Kelly screamed, you're nothing like him. He's nothing like you. And I said, we're exactly alike. The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous hasn't happened in his life, but we're exactly alike. And she said, well, even if you are, he isn't walking me up the aisle. And I asked her a very simple question. I said, how will this read to you 10 years from now, or 20 years from now, or 30 years from now? I said, think about that. And I said, number two, when he was sending you to Austria to go skiing and all the rest of it, you didn't feel this way about him. I said, when he was doing well, you took the money and ran. Now he needs you. Why are you doing this? She thought about it. She told me, she said, I hate it, but you're right. And so she let him walk her up the aisle, and it was beautiful to watch. And he was as sober as he could be for 6 o'clock in the evening. And it became very evident to me that he loved them every bit as much as I did. And I realized how much harder it was for him to be there than me. I remember what it was like when I was drunk and I was places I needed to be and how hard it was. This step works. It really, really works. And it works in all areas of our lives. This business of making a list is a very, very important business. And I think that the eighth step is one of the times when excess is okay. So make a long, long list. Put everybody on there. If you think you offended the guy at the checkout counter in the grocery store, put him down. Remember, these aren't people you're going to have to go make amends to. These are people you're considering for the possibility of making an amends. That's all it is. It's people. You don't want to miss anybody. There's a great promise to the eighth and ninth step, and an old timer told me this one time. I said to him, why should I do this crap? Why don't I just move? And he said, well, that's one way. He said, but if you move, he said, you'll still spend the rest of your life worrying about who you're going to run into when you walk around the corner. He said, if you'll stay here and do this simple thing, the day will come when you won't be afraid of who you're going to walk into when you walk around the corner. It just won't matter. Now, that's probably not true in Miami or Washington, D.C. or places, but it's true in most of the rest of the world. I am no longer afraid of who I'm going to run into. I'm just not afraid anymore. I belong in a world in which I live, and directly attributable to the eighth and ninth step. The eighth step talks about harm and how is it that we do harm. I think harm is certainly defined in a number of ways, but people debate those issues instead of starting to write down names. Surely there are at least a few people in your lives who you can start the list with. And I find that the hardest part about the list is starting it. And I'll tell you what I do with the guys I sponsor, and if this works for you, fine. What I have them do is to take their list of people, and they list them. And then we sit down, and we discuss them. And we may do it over a 2 or 3 or 4 week period. You know, we may get together and discuss some, and then go off to a meeting or something and get together and discuss some others. And based on their description of the harm that was done, we decide whether or not they really owe an amends to this person. I was at lunchtime, I was telling them about a guy I sponsor who had a woman's name on the list, and I said, what do you owe this woman amends for? And he said, I fired her husband, and he ended up dying drunk. And I said, well, tell me about it. He said, well, he's a president and CEO of a company. And he said this guy was, you know, had a bad drinking problem, and he talked to him about it, and he, you know, gave him 8 or 10 or 20 chances or something like that. And the guy kept drinking, so he fired him, and he said a few years later he died drunk, and I want to make amends to his ex-wife, his widow. And I said, why do you owe an amends? I mean, if you owe an amends to anybody, you owe an amends to the board of directors of the company that was paying you to run their company. I said, what are you hanging around, what are you keeping this drunken bum around for 5 years trying to save him? I said, you didn't do your job. Your job was to pull the plug on him right away, or, you know, as soon as it became evident that he wasn't willing to change. I said, take the woman off the list and put the board of directors down there. So he took the women off and he put the board of directors down. And he already had his company on the list. But so we'd go through this list and we would discuss each case. And it's important, I think, and the book says that, it's important that we know the rationale for the amends that we're making. Because three things happen when we make the amends, and I'll read them in a minute in the book. Okay, it's the very first paragraph. In the 12 and 12, the 8, 7, the 12 and 12. But we make this list of folks. Why do I keep thinking I can do this without my glasses? Doing the same thing, expecting a different result. God's going to fix it so my arms are longer next time. Steps 8 and 9 are concerned with personal relationships. First, we take a look backward and try to discover where we have been at fault, number one. Next, we make a vigorous attempt to repair the damage we have done, number two. And third, having thus cleared away the debris of the past, we now consider how our newfound knowledge of ourselves may develop the best possible relationships with every human being we know. So the idea of the amends isn't just to fix or to amend what's gone on. It's so we can learn about ourselves and we can make the best possible decisions concerning our present and future relationships. If I didn't learn anything from my marriage, what kind of a husband could I be now? If I didn't learn anything about the damage I'd done to others in my life, what kind of a friend or son or husband or brother could I be now? So it's not just about those people. It's about what we do with the rest of our lives based on the knowledge that we gain. What I have these guys do is once they get this list, and we've gone through the whole list and they've sort of pared it down and gotten rid of the ego trips and all the other things that often end up on that list, I then suggest that they take 3 by 5 cards and write the name of each person on that card. And then I suggest that they keep those cards with their big book and their morning reading material. And that in the morning, they just not make a big deal out of it, but just basically thumb through those cards, asking God for the ability to forgive anybody in that group that they have anything against. Forgiveness is a funny thing. A lot of times it takes me a long time to recognize my need for forgiveness. I'll have things against people I'm not even aware I have against them. I'll call it judgment. And what it really is something that I'm angry about or something that I need to forgive them for, I'm hurt over or something like that. And I have them do that. And then I said from time to time, this name will pop up and you'll recognize something about it. You can jot a few notes on the back of that card. And it works very, very well. And what happens to me through this process is I end up not only recognizing who I owe an amends to, but why I owe that amends. And it's very, very important, because otherwise I run the risk of going back to the people that I've always gone to get whatever it was I was looking for. And I may still be looking to get that. And if I understand what the question is, I'll often know how to deal with it. I'll give you an example. And I've talked to other people who've had the same sort of a problem. I used to go to make amends to my father. And my father was this very stoic, silent man who never told me he loved me. That and my mother's square nipple were the reason I was the way I was. And if only he had told me he loved me, I'd have been a very different fellow, certainly a fine fellow, but he never told me that. That's what was wrong with me. And so I lived in Washington, D.C., and they lived in Ohio, and it's 300 miles. And I'd get in the car, and I'd drive 300 miles to make direct amends to my father, and we'd have a cup of coffee, and about 10 minutes later, I'd be in a rage. I'd jump up, I'd run out of the house, get in the car, and drive back to Washington. And I'd call up Dan and I'd scream at him, it doesn't work, it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And he'd say, oh, it works. You just have to pray a little bit more. Right? Tell Sandy that, and he'd say the same thing. We have to pray a little bit more. It works. And then, you know, I did this about 3 or 4 times, and finally my father said to my mother, he said, you know, Keith's a fine young man, but I worry about him. He said, he drives a long way for a cup of coffee. And why should I be surprised? I mean, he's a man who doesn't read his own distress, and he ain't going to read distress around him. I mean, that isn't what he does. What he does is he works and he loves and he sacrifices and he gives up, and that's the way you live your life. And oh, that I could have had those values years ago. So finally the time came when I had prayed enough and it had worked. And I had prayed about this and I had written on that little card, and suddenly I realized what the problem was. And by this time, I'd had a little house down on the ocean, and this will be a surprise to some of you, but my father had never seen the ocean. You know, he had never been on a vacation. I mean, if you live in Ohio, if you see the ocean, you made a wrong turn. And he had just never seen the ocean. And I had a little house down on the Carolina Beach, and so I was living in Fayetteville at the time, and I called my parents up and said, why don't you come down and stay at the beach house? So he came down, and my brother Larry met us at the town, and he took my dad down, and then I brought my mom down the next day. But Larry took Dad to the ocean and to the little beach house, and he describes this scene. He said that Dad just stood there and watched the waves just coming in. He just stood there in awe. And he said to Larry, does it just keep doing that? Larry said, as far as I know, it just keeps doing that. And when I, a couple years later, I left to go to Alabama to live for a couple years, and I called my mom and dad up. He had then retired, and I called him up and said, is there any chance I could get you and mom to come and keep an eye on the beach house, make sure nothing happens to it? And he said, yeah, I'd like to do that. So they kept an eye on it for 6 years. They kept an eye on the beach house. And I went down to the beach house to make direct amends to Dad. And I'll never forget this day as long as I live. He was sitting in a rocking chair smoking his pipe. He's since quit but he smoked a pipe. And we just started talking. And I didn't know that I went there to make amends. That wasn't my intention. I just went there to see my parents. And we were talking. And he began talking to me, and things sort of developed. And then he said to me, he said, you know, he said, I've always felt bad. And I said, why is that, Dad? He said, well, he said, all your brothers and sisters, you know, they always let me help them a little bit. And he said, you never let me help you. I said, what do you mean, Dad? You taught me how to play baseball. You taught me how to play checkers. He said, no. He said, but you never let me help you after you were so old. He said, They let me help them go to college, and you went to college on your own, and you got scholarships, and you worked, and you did all these things. And it suddenly occurred to me that I had deprived him of what he did best, which was to be a parent. And I deprived him of the right to parent me. And I understood why I owed him an amends, because I didn't allow him to do what he did better than anybody I've ever known, and that's to parent and to give. And somewhere along the line, we crossed messages. And I interpreted what he did to mean that he didn't care about me. And an interesting thing happens when you begin to make discoveries like this. I began to see things in an entirely different light. I began to remember things I couldn't remember before. You know, if you have everything invested in blaming someone else for what's happened to you, it becomes important to take out all the good things, because you can't give this person credit for anything. And I remembered that I was a very sick little kid when I was born. I had a bad speech impediment. I was a very sickly little kid. And I couldn't do most of the things that other kids did for a number of years. And I remember a time when we were down at the swimming pool. And we were sitting on a bench, and Dad was, it just sort of like came to me. And Dad was sitting next to me, and he had a blanket around me. In the middle of the summer, he had a blanket around me. And he had his arm around me. And we were watching the other kids swim. And he said, one day you'll swim. When God thinks you're ready, you'll swim. Everything sort of came home to me in a very powerful way. How I'd misjudged this man. How I needed to blame him for the way I was. And we began to talk, and he said to me, he said, remember the first day you went to work? And I said, Well, sort of. I said, I remember my first job was at Jimmy Lamont's bowling alley, setting pins. And he said, yeah. He said, you were 12 years old. And he said, remember what happened that day? And I said, no, I don't. And he said, well, he said, I took you to lunch. He said, we went to Louis' hot dog stand. He said, you remember what you had for lunch? And I said, I'm going to go way out on a limb, Dad, a hot dog? And he said, of course you had a hot dog. He said, but do you remember what you drank? And I said, I probably had an orange pop. I always drank orange pop. He said, not that day. He said, that day you drank root beer. And I said, I did? He said, yeah. He said, I drank root beer, and I think you thought men who worked drank root beer. So you drank root beer. And he said, and then we walked down to the bus stop, and this job was in the next town, and I had to take a bus. And he said, I said to you, you want me to go with you on your first day? And he said, I had explained to you about doing a good day's work for a good day's pay, and he said, I explained to you that you owed a man you worked for some respect, but he owed you respect too, because you were a working man, and working men deserve respect too. And then he said to me, I said to you, do you want me to come down with you on your first day? And you said, no thanks, Dad, I'll do it myself. He said, you got on that bus, and I stood there and watched it till it went out of sight, and you never looked back. He said, from that time on, I never felt as though I ever had the right to tell you anything. He said, you bought your own clothes, you paid your own way. I never felt I had the right to tell you anything. The book says that I'll find that I force most people to treat me the way they treat me. Now, that was never intentional on my part, nor was it intentional on his part. It's just the reality of a situation that needed to be amended. And the strangest thing happened about a month later. I really needed to borrow about $3,000. I went to Dad and said, Dad, I really need to borrow about $3,000 for about 3 months. Is that all right? Oh, that's fine, son. That's fine. And he took me to the bank. He didn't write checks. He took me to the bank and he got $3,000 in cash and gave it to me. He said, now be real careful. There are some really strange people around. And so I ran to the bank and got a cashier's check, and I put that $3,000 in my account, and I saved it for a few months, and then I gave it back to him. And our lives have changed. I finally allowed him, when I was 40 years of age, to be the kind of parent that he always wanted. I think that things like this are important because it allows me to be the kind of parent that I want to be. And it reminds me that when I talk with my kids and when I spend time with my kids, they really may not hear how much I love them, because they also may have another set of criteria. You know, once the decision is made as to how things are, all the communications are directed by that decision. You know, I went off to Paris Island, and like I say, I loved it. And I had some problems. I busted up a kidney, and just the usual stuff that can happen to you in high-risk situations. And I went to some hospitals and things, but I came back, and I graduated from Paris Island, and I graduated with a lot of honors. I was given Dress Blues Award, an Outstanding Man's Award, just a lot of fine things. And I wrote my father and asked him if he wanted to come to graduation, and he got on a bus. We didn't have a car or anything, and he got on a bus, and he only owned one suit. And it was a wool suit. When you're in Ohio, it doesn't matter, because everything that's important happens in the wintertime. And but he's in July, Paris Island, South Carolina, in his wool suit. And he's a man who's afraid of a lot of things and had never gone anywhere, never done anything, and other than raise 11 mostly ungrateful children in a few kids who had no place else to go. And he's down there really out of his element and everything, and he would get a little critical of the military, then he'd stop himself. But after this ceremony was over, they had me out there, and they had parades and all sorts of things. They gave me all these things, and then he took pictures of me and my dad in his wool suit and the colonel and shaking hands and all that stuff. And then we're leaving the drill field, and I had all these awards and things, and he said to me, he said, boy, son, he said, you know, if you'd have gone to college instead of here, you could have had straight A's. And I knew he was telling me that what I did wasn't good enough. Years later, after we made the amends, my wife and I were sitting in the living room of this little beach house with my mom and dad, and we were just talking about what had happened to all the kids and how God had blessed us and all that stuff. My dad said, "Yeah, remember when you graduated from Paris Island?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "That was one of the proudest moments of my life." He said, "I always had the feeling that you thought that what you did wasn't as good as what Denny and Patty were doing in school. So I said to you, you know, this is the same as getting straight A's in school." You know, what I believe dictates what I hear. I believe he thought I wasn't much, and that's what I heard him say to me. She met my dad, who loved her desperately, without reservation. And God, she was a horribly impractical person. I mean, when she should have been doing dishes, she'd be reciting poetry to us. She was a woman who never finished high school, and she read a book a day her entire life. She slept about 3 hours out of 24. That's all she ever required. And she finally went back to high school after we all finished, and then took her college entrance exams and outscored all of us. She'd say, "Why not?" She'd been to high school 11 times. And then when she retired and moved down to the ocean, she began to paint. And she was a superb artist. It was just amazing. I mean, woman with incredible talents. And I always felt close to Mom. It was funny, when I went off to the service, before I went, I used to work at a drugstore, and every Saturday afternoon I'd come home for lunch, and I'd always stop and pick up a roast beef sandwich for Mom, and Mom would always make me two cheeseburgers, and so we'd have lunch together, and she'd have the roast beef sandwich, and I'd have the two cheeseburgers, and we'd just talk about life and things like that, and about poetry and music or something, and the day I was away at the Marine Corps, and the next Saturday she just got up and she fixed the cheeseburgers, and then she realized I wouldn't be coming home for lunch, and she sat down and began to cry, and my dad came in and said, "What's the matter, Pat?" And she said, "Keith's gone, and he's not coming back for the cheeseburgers." And he said, "Don't worry, I'll eat the cheeseburgers." She said, "Don't you touch those cheeseburgers." And you know, after I caused them so much distress and so much worry and anxiety, I was one of those crazy drunks who might be gone for a month and they wouldn't hear from me, and then I'd be in Spain or someplace. And so early in my sobriety, about 4 years, Mom came up to visit me, and I explained what I was doing, and I took her to a meeting, Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was the night that I picked up my first chip, which was a 4-year chip. That was the first one I had, and we didn't have them before that. And I talked to her, and I said, "Is there anything I can do to make amends?" And she said, "Boy, I'd like to have one of those coins." So the 13th of May every year, I'd give her one of those coins. And if I didn't send it, she'd call me by the 14th and saying, "It must have gotten lost in the mail, son." And no, it'll be there. And she came to love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I realized that the amends I owed her was that there were times in my life when I cut her out of my life. And my life, the lives of all her children, were always very important to her. She was one of those people who would sit down next to you on a bus or something. She had a huge purse. She didn't have anything in it but a picture. And it was all the kids. And she'd tell you what they're doing and who they're married to and all the rest of it. She'd just make you crazy. Because her kids were her life. And I cut her out of that. And it was my privilege over the years to have her be very much a part of my life and very much a part of my sobriety. The little beach house that they lived in had a sign on it that said, "CZ does it," S-E-A-Z does it. People would stop by and they'd say to my mother, "Oh, I saw the sign on the house. Are you a friend of Bill Wilson?" And she'd say, "No, my son's a good friend of Bill Wilson," and she'd invite him in for iced tea and everything. So people, all around, there were some kids who came down to visit, and I'd met them some years before at a conference, and they rode down on their motorcycles, and I got home, and there were two Harleys in the driveway, and Julia had gotten home a little before me, and they were talking, and they said, "Would you mind if we just rode down to the ocean just to meet your parents?" I said, "Well, it'd be wonderful." I said, "They said, we have to go back, but we'll just ride down. It's only a couple hours." So I gave them directions and everything, and then I forgot to call my parents, and about 5 days later, I remembered that these kids were going down there, so I called. My dad got on the phone. I said, "Dad, it's me." "Oh, hi, son." I said, "I hope I didn't scare you." I said, "But two of my friends came down on motorcycles because they wanted to meet you." He said, "Yeah, you want to talk to them?" I said, they still there? He said, oh yeah, we tell them, you don't come clear down from Ohio and turn around and go back up. That doesn't make any sense at all. Why don't you stay for a week or two? So my amends to my mom was loving her the way she wanted to be loved, and that was with tremendous appreciation for everything that she had done. She's an extraordinary woman, and she passed away, like I said, a year ago in June, and the debt was paid. It was all done. It was complete. And you know, when she, towards the very end, I would go down at night, and like me, she loved the rosary very much, and I'd pray a rosary aloud at night, and she'd be in and out consciousness, and she'd wake up and just smile and pray for a while, and then drift back out. And my sisters had put pictures of all the kids and the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren on the wall, and she would look at that and smile and go back to sleep. And then I'd always ask that that when she passed away, it was a secret prayer of my own. I always ask Mary, who was very important to me, to come with my brother Terry to take Mom home when her time came. And my brother Henry was sitting with Mom and the night she died, and he said to me, he said, it was the strangest thing. He said, I was wide awake. He said, all of a sudden, he said, it's like I just sort of went out for a second. And he said, when I awoke, Mom was gone. And I said, really? He said, yeah, it's the strangest thing. He said, I felt three people brush by me. And I know that that Mom left in good hands. And I don't know how people say goodbye to their parents. I mean, I really don't know that. The day after Mom was buried, Dad had a bad stroke, and he was 84 years old. And all the local psychologists in the family were saying, Dad misses Mom, and he wants to follow her as soon as he can. They had all this figured out. And Dad thinks he just had a stroke. And so he took him to the hospital, and they told him, you know, Mr. Lewis, you have carotid artery blockage, but we can't clear those out because if we do that, your heart won't take it because you need heart surgery, but we can't do heart surgery because if we do that, you'll have a stroke. And Dad, being eminently practical, said, well, why don't you do them both at the same time? And they said, that's awfully risky. You're 84 years old. He said, how the hell do you think I got to be like this? And so they figured that sort of courage required at least a shot. And so a little over a year ago, Dad had two surgeries at once that would have killed a younger person. And I want to tell you, he's doing beautifully. He's still walking a few miles a day, and he's still running everybody's life who will get close enough. And I said to him one time, I said, I knew you weren't finished. I knew that you weren't ready to go. And he said, the way I loved your mother and the way your mother loved life, it would be an insult to her memory to not to want to live. And I just continue to learn from them, continue to learn. This whole business of the eighth and ninth step is very, very personal. It's personal to me, it's personal for me to talk about it, and it's very, very personal to each and every one of us. And that's what prepares us, I'm convinced, to go out into the world completely free. When we deal with all of it that's so personal, we're then ready to go out in the world and be completely free. And I could go on and on. I have a few more people on that list. There's one man's been on the list for over 20 years, and I'm going to see him 2 weeks from now in Rochester, New York, and I'm going to be able to make amends to this man directly. I haven't been able to find him until about a month ago, and I found him. Somebody helped me find him, and they found him for me. And I don't know why I'm supposed to do that amends now. Maybe there's no reason. Or maybe it's a reason I'll never know. But what I know is that 2 weeks from now, I'll put one more stone in this wall that's being built, the steps that are leading to the good life. We've covered the first nine steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're often referred to as the steps that prepare us to live a happy and fruitful life, a life established by a set of principles by which we can live, and it's based upon the desire to be useful to others, to enjoy life, to be sure, but to be useful to God and to our fellows. We can take a little bit of a break. We'll get to steps 10, and step 10 is a very, very important step in the next phase of our development. Thank you. The barn is in sight. We're nearly finished, and I'm gonna finish up in plenty of time to get us out and some sunshine and things like that. If anybody has any questions or would like to talk about anything, please feel free to get me after this, okay? I'm going to probably go put on some shorts and sit out in the sunshine for a little bit or something like that, but please feel free to grab me if you want to discuss anything. And I know that that Father has time available, and many of you have signed up to talk to him. Continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I think of the 10th step. I always think of a phrase I heard an old-timer say one time. He called it the art of living. The art of living. One of the things that happens, I live like you, many of you do. I live in a beautiful part of the country. I think it's a section of North Carolina, southeastern North Carolina, some of the most beautiful. You know, I live, you know, near the ocean and around a lot of nice golf courses, and it's a small town, and it's a pretty interesting town. We make a lot of movies, and there's a lot of history associated with it, and it's the first capital of the Carolinas, and on and on, and it's just really a very, very beautiful place, and it's the kind of place that people want to come and spend the rest of their lives. And I watch a phenomenon that is, in a sense, sort of frightening to me. I watch a group of people come to where I live, and many of them not get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they move there from Ohio and Pennsylvania and New Jersey and in places where the snow still flies, and something happens to them, and I often thought about it, and I recognized that this business of change in our life is a critical one for alcoholics, that change often causes us to shift this foundation that we've established over a period of years working these steps. And I've had occasion to talk to these people, some of whom have gotten drunk and some of whom haven't fortunately gotten drunk, but have gotten themselves in pretty bad emotional state before they came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it seems to me that two things happened to these people. Number one, they stopped working with new people. Now, they didn't stop working with new people when they came to Wilmington. They had stopped working with new people prior to leaving where they were. The new person was just out of their life. They had other concerns. They were wrapping up their jobs, or they were selling their house, or they were doing this, or they were doing that. And it's critical, I think, for those of us who want to hang on to this thing, to stay meaningfully involved with the new person. The other thing that they stopped doing is they stopped seeking the counsel of others. And they went back to that person who had always given them the answers they wanted, and that was self. They had begun being sponsored again by themselves. Or even if they continued to be sponsored, they were sort of sponsored in name, and they weren't telling their sponsor anything that was going on with them. And I think what happens to people, that happens to us when we face change, is that we often tend to re-isolate. My friend Bob H., I watched him do this when he moved to Pinehurst. Bob went to a meeting every day for 90 days and passed until he felt like a member again. And he was sober 25 years when he moved to Pinehurst. Sober a long time. And yet he recognized the need to become meaningfully involved very quickly. And I think a lot of this relates to the 10th step. We continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I can't understand how anybody could be sober any length of time in Alcoholics Anonymous and not be so excited about membership in this organization. It just amazes me. Given half a chance, I could, you know, feel like I was an Amway. I mean, I could be cheering and just all sorts of stuff because to be privileged to watch what I watch happen in the lives of people. I mean, I just can't understand what could take the place of that until I get re-involved in self. And it's a really subtle sort of a phenomenon, this business of self. How self gets back involved with me. How things become very important in my life all of a sudden. Financial things or something, they become very important in my life. I begin to obsess with financial things, or I begin to obsess with this or with that. And so I understand, of course, it's very easy to do that. And the 10th step tells me that vigilance is necessary if I'm to continue to live this kind of a life. And the vigilance is something that we do on a daily basis. I want to tell you sort of briefly how I do the 10th step. I do a couple of things. But number one is I'm a person who likes to journal. I don't journal every day. There was a time when I did. But I don't do it every day now. But I journal fairly often. And whenever I am faced with indecision, or whenever I'm feeling out of sorts, I don't have bad times anymore. I mean, sometimes I feel out of sorts. I always like to sit down and get a number two pencil and a yellow pad and just write. Just write what's going on and on and on. And one of the things I've done over the years, and I did for many, many years, is I sit down every morning and I would open the book to page 86 and I go to the first paragraph. And it says, upon awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. And what I like to do, and if this works for you fine, I would always start each day with a clean page. It's not very friendly to trees, but at least I'm not running into them in my car anymore. So I start on a fresh page, because each day is a fresh page. And I write the date down. And I do something that goes back to the time when I couldn't pray. There was a time when I could not pray. And so what I did was I used to write a letter to God. So I will write a letter to God. And if you go back 20-some years and look at what I wrote, the letters were sort of short. Something like, hey you, or if you're there, or to whom it may concern. Or something. It was real personal. I mean, I was real close to God then, and you could just tell by what I wrote. Now it's dearest Father, or whatever I'm moved to write, but I write a short letter to God. And then I begin to read page 86 in the book. And it says, upon awakening, we think about the 24 hours ahead. And it tells me precisely how to plan my day. And I'll sit down and I'll write my plan for that day. I say, well, I like to do this and this and this and this and this. A fellow I'm sponsoring who's sober around 12 years. Remember I said 12 was often a critical time. And here's a man who's really worked this program well. And I'm very proud of what he's done over the years. And he's come to know God and to understand him in a way and things. And he's very active in his church and all that stuff. But he's at loose ends. He came to me and he's at loose ends. And he's this and he's that. And he's at the phase of his life where organization is important to him. I mean, organization is not a bad word. Alcoholics don't like it. But it's really not a bad word. So I've begun to teach him how he can organize his life and to write down the things he wants to accomplish today. Something as simple as that. And I'd say, you know, often the night before, people sit down and they write down what they'd like to accomplish tomorrow. And I said, and then the next morning, you can look at this list of things and you can say, well, I can get to this, I can't get to that. But you can make some real decisions. The problem with not writing it down is that you run the risk of always feeling as though you're lost. Feeling as though I'm not getting anything done. And in reality, you may be getting 90% of what you want to get done. But if you don't define it, then that 10% that you're not getting done will make you feel like you're spinning your wheels. They're very simple little things. And I showed him how to... I made him go and buy an organizer. I mean, spend some money. I said, if you don't spend some money on this, you're past the old pad stage. If you don't spend some money on this, it won't be important to you. So I made him go and buy a nice leather organizer, and he writes those things down, and in his life, his business, everything is running very, very smoothly because he's organizing it. And the 10th step is a lot about organizing our lives so that we can be of maximum service to God and to our fellows. And if you'll read page 86, I won't do it for you because you know how to read, but if you'll read page 86 87 and 88 in the big book, to tell you precisely how to run your day, how to plan it. It'll tell you what to watch out for. It'll caution you not to drift into worry or morbid it'll caution you how to deal with life when you get thrown off. It'll tell you to pause and to think back to what the original plan was, to say something like, "Thy will, not mine, be done," and how we can stay on the beam throughout the course of the day. You know, when I was drinking and I was newly sober, I felt like a pinball in a pinball machine. Remember that? I mean, I'd go over and I'd hit this bumper and it'd throw me over there, and I'd hit that bumper, and you know, like every morning I was flung up that chute. And I never knew where the hell I was going to end up. You know, I knew I was going to go down the chute before the day was over, but I never knew where I'd be before I got to the chute. And I reacted to life. I mean,